Good morning, everyone. I'm sorry I'm an innocent victim of the old German education system some 40 years ago. So we practiced Latin instead of practicing French. So I have to stick to English. I'm very sorry about that. I'm still absolutely thrilled about the presentation of Christian. I didn't know that WikiLeaks is such a great organization. When I looked at their website last time, which was actually yesterday, I saw a lot about the wrongdoings of the US, and I saw about a lot about the wrongdoings of the Western world in front of Syria. I saw nothing about Russia and the wrongdoings of Mr. Putin. I saw nothing about China. I saw nothing about North Korea. And I saw nothing about so many African countries and African regimes. So I have to say it was absolutely balanced, and it's absolutely good for journalism. Let me briefly introduce what we do at Geopolitical Information Service. The company was founded, as Cynthia told, in 2011 for one simple reason. We thought that international companies, and I'm sorry, I have no slides, because I want to keep your attention to what I'm saying here and not to reading the slides. So the simple reason for why we are exist is that international companies, but also governments, as well as NGOs and other organizations, they usually need really solid background information and analysis on geopolitically relevant subjects in order to make professional decisions in their business and in their undertakings. So they need really access to insights. So what we are a global intelligence service. We are not CIA, we are not WikiLeaks, but we provide independent, analytical, fact-based reports from a team of experts that we did put together, and these experts come from around the world. And we provide our clients with access to insights. So it's not just on the surface information, access to insights in the fields of geopolitics, economics, defense, security, and energy. On top of that, and this is something very important, our experts, they provide certain scenarios on these political, significant political events and trends. So they use their knowledge to analyze the big picture and provide a valuable recommendation of what is likely to happen next in a form that provides help for long-term decision-making. All our content is original content. We are not a content aggregator. We don't steal content, and we don't publish stolen content. We are unbiased. We don't make moral or ethical judgments. We don't give advice how to make the world a better place. But we help our clients, at least we try to help our clients, to reach informed decisions. Our experts, they play active roles usually in top universities, in think tanks, in intelligence services, in business, or as government advisors. So they have a unique blend of backgrounds and experience to deliver the narrative and understanding of global developments. And understanding global developments, understanding geopolitics, I think is of vital importance in our globalized world. Understanding is the result of a process which usually involves our brain. However, before we are able to understand something, we need to feed our brain with information and explanations, as well as with various opinions. And that all of that information has to come from trusted sources. One thing is true, the access to information is one of the pillars of democracy, and it is the basis for any kind of understanding and opinion building. Today, and now I really come to the subject, we actually live in a world of constant information overflow. And it all started in 1991 when the internet was technically made available for commercial purposes worldwide. It existed before, but only for academia and the US Defense Ministry. And today, it's 2.4 billion people around the world that use the internet. We count 246 million top-level domains and 634 million websites. In the end, that means that almost 35% of the world's population today is connected. So in just 20 years, technology enabled a communication revolution. But there's more. The launch of Facebook, which is today the synonym for social media, which was launched in 2004, this created a new dimension of communication. Suddenly, people started to share information with people they never ever physically met. Facebook claimed 955 million member logins in October 2012. So, since they don't really disclose their member figures, I guess that now by 2013, this figure is beyond 1 billion people all in all. Also, what is surprising, people don't only share news, they also share personal experiences, pictures, and videos on Facebook. Facebook today is next to Google the second most visited website. Actually, Google had 1.2 trillion searches last year. So the hunger for information is there still. Actually, 24% of the world's top 10,000 websites, they carry Facebook buttons. And 2.7 billion people click on this Like It button every day. In 2005, YouTube was founded. And today, it's about 2 billion videos that are watched daily on YouTube alone. So there are also other YouTube kind of channels. And every minute, around about 35 hours of video content is being uploaded. And two of the countries that actually use and share most of the videos here on YouTube are Saudi Arabia, which I think is number three in the world, and China. In 2006, also with the rise of smartphones, another communications service started, which was called Twitter. Stories were told using 140 characters, so another peak in communication was reached. In 2012, an average of 175 million tweets were sent daily. Surprisingly enough, the usage of Facebook and Twitter is not limited to the young generation. It's not limited to the digital natives. With an average user age of above 40 and slightly below 40 years, respectively, it's clear that also a large number of digital immigrants or silver servers are using these services. And of course, the development of smartphones helped to achieve these figures. The first smartphone, I don't know, who could think of which was the first smartphone? And when was it launched? Any idea, anyone? Yes, Nokia, correct. Which one? The Nokia Communicator. The Nokia Communicator. It was launched in 1996. And this was then followed by products like BlackBerry and Palm OS. Now, all of these devices had one thing in common. They were very difficult to set up. I keep saying I tried it for 2 days without any success. Then I went in the company to our IT people and said, can you set it up? They worked on it for 2 days, managed it. It worked for 2 days, and then it failed again. But the iPhone, which was launched in 2007, changed that. The iPhone was the first absolute, completely idiot-proof communication device that was launched in the market. Today, we have round about 1.3 billion smartphones that are in use. The number of these users is actually a little bit lower, which means that 200 million people in the world have more than one smartphone. Not more than one phone, more than one smartphone. So in the last 20 years, communication definitely has become ubiquitous. The access to information is possible anywhere, on any device, and at any time. So one of the ideas some 10 years ago about communication of the future has become reality. However, the origin of all mass communication, which was the origin of all mass communication? How many journalists are here in the room? None. Okay. Okay. What was the origin of all mass communication? The newspaper. The printed newspaper. The printed newspaper today is suffering. The first newspaper was started really as a mass publication more than 400 years ago. And over many years, it really has established its role as the watchdog of the governments, reporting about governmental issues, but also about business and society. And it has always been the most trusted source of information. And still today, newspapers claim to reach 2.4 billion people daily in the world. And still today, surprise, surprise, newspapers are the second most trusted source of information. There's only one source of information that is more trusted than the newspaper, and this is a recommendation from a friend. Whether these are all Facebook friends, I don't know. I don't think so. However, the business model of newspapers has also changed several times in its history. For most of the time, its business focused on selling subscription and selling advertising for a printed product. Before the internet age put really a big question mark behind this business model. Though newspapers are often called independent or non-partisan, you see it in a lot of headlines, nowadays they were directly linked to a party for many years in their history, and is not only in the old Eastern world, but also in the old Western world. And even today, I dare to raise the question if newspapers in the free world are really non-partisan. Very often you get a completely different feeling about that. When the internet started its success story, the classic newspapers had problems to follow and no chance to be ahead. The internal structures were too rigid and too much in opposition towards the new digital world. Online journalists were seen as second-class reporters. The opportunities of the digital world were missed completely. It took almost 10 years before the word, the phrase, this buzzword, convergence, found its way into the newsrooms, and before newspapers around the world started to change their newsrooms, usually pushed by a never-ending newspaper crisis. Besides all the efforts to include audio, video, apps, citizen journalism, and so on and so on, besides becoming local and hyper-local and hyper-hyper-hyper-local, a resilient business model that might replace print in terms of revenues and profits is not in sight. I don't want to talk really about press freedom here, because we all know that there are many countries in the world where press freedom simply does not exist. And this not only in the Eastern world, or in Africa, or in Latin America, even here in Europe. But press freedom should not be muddled up with transparency of information. This is two completely different things. In countries where there's no press freedom, no freedom of speech, of course, complete transparency also remains a dream. However, if we look at the opportunities the new communication technologies are offering, if we look at what is being posted on Twitter, YouTube, or any of these social media channels, it really has to be stated that the world has become a lot more transparent in the last 20 years. However, the world also has become a lot more complex in the last 20 years. Let me finish with some remarks on what I'd like to see changed for more transparency and for more reliable information, because that is what the people want. The people want to have a trusted source, a reliable and resilient information. And they want to have an explanation of why is something happening. And just a little pre-warning, there will be some very critical remarks. It seems to me that reporting is out and was replaced by sensationalism already a while ago. Witch hunts have become daily business, even in serious publications. And even though I live in Liechtenstein today, my home country is Germany, and we had a number of this kind of witch hunts in the last years, which helped ousting presidents, sports people, etc., etc. And it was a big surprise that even the most serious publications, not the Bild-Zeitung, actually participated in this witch hunt. Publishing stolen data, which are declared top secret, and information that might put other people's lives at risk, has nothing to do with serious journalism, nor with fighting for transparency. Publishing stolen information, to discredit companies has nothing to do with journalism, nor with supporting transparency. Criminal acts to get hold of information, like phone hacking, has nothing to do with serious journalism, nor does it add to transparency. Instead, serious research, background information, and an outlook what is likely to happen next, this would help foster a position as a trusted source of information. A multi-angle view with input from experts from around the globe. And it's quite surprising how many people know the stuff that is usually not published in a newspaper. So with a little bit of input from these experts, this would help create transparency. And don't forget, readers got brain. A separation between the report and the opinion piece will help create transparency as well. And here I have a wonderful example, which is several years back, and it was before the Iraq war. And I was on a business trip from Nuremberg in Germany to Melbourne in Florida. So I had to change a number of planes, and I was able to read four newspapers. The local newspaper of Nuremberg, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, the Financial Times, and USA Today. It was the day after Mr. Blix has reported about weapons of mass destruction. And of course, this was the top story in all four newspapers. And all four reports were based on news agency information, which you could clearly see. And they were all rewritten as opinion pieces. And now I could think that Mr. Blix probably had three brothers reporting about four completely different countries. My home newspaper said, there is nothing, there was never anything, forget about it. He found it out. Proven with quotes. Süddeutsche Zeitung said, well, most likely there is nothing, but we cannot be quite sure. And Mr. Blix is not quite sure. The Financial Times said, most likely there is something. We're not sure yet, but give him some time. He will find out. And USA Today, we know, he said, well, there is something, and Let's go for it. That is not journalism. That is opinion pieces. Yes, next point. Give up the information monopoly. It doesn't exist any longer anyway. Social media is very often much better informed than the usual media. Collaboration and sharing is actually a way to success and to more transparency. And the very last point is, be prepared that too much transparency in the wrong hands is very dangerous. Thank you.